Good morning, everyone. Happy New Year. This is the last and first, I think it's maybe the first time I say that, but it'll be the last time I say Happy New Year. I'm not going to drag it on for months and weeks and everything, so just to warn you. In your, another insert that you have in your bulletins was a really helpful diagram for me. It'll help us this morning a little bit, but have that kind of ready. I'll talk about that in a minute. But we're also looking at Nehemiah 1, so if you want to turn to Nehemiah 1 and have that open, we'll be reading the whole first chapter of Nehemiah 1 this year. Or this week anyway, maybe not this whole year, but when we think about New Year's, right, we think about resolutions. We think about changing something about ourselves, and one thing, a couple stories that I read this week that I thought were good to point us to resolutions and the New Year. The first one is this idea that this high school principal asked all of his teachers to put him, give him resolutions that they're going to make this year, and he was going to post them on the bulletin board so that everybody could see them and all the rest of the teachers could read them. And one of the teachers was complaining when they got posted and said, "Oh, where's mine at? Why didn't he post mine?" And the principal looks and he gets a little nervous, and so he races to his office to see if he maybe mislaid it or did something with it. And the teacher's making such a racket and throwing such a tantrum that the principal is really hurrying to try to see, did I lose it? Did I mislay it? And sure enough, he finds it in his pile of paper on his desk, and he pulls it out and he's ready to go put it on the board, and he glances at the first list from this teacher that's throwing this temper tantrum. And the first resolution she has was not to get upset over the little things in the new year. Or maybe this idea of the son, he's calling his parents in the new year. And the dad was talking to the son at college, and the son says, "Well, Dad, what's your New Year's resolution? I'm trying to come up with one, and I can't think of anything." And the son and the dad says, "Well, it's pretty straightforward. I just want to make your mother happy all year long." All right, that's a good resolution. I think it's a good one anyway. And the son says, "Okay, that sounds great." And then they pass the phone to mom, and son's talking to mom, and he asks the same question. "You know, Mom, what's your New Year's resolution?" And mom said, "Mine's pretty straightforward. All I want to do is help your dad keep his resolution this year." And my favorite probably is the mentality of Calvin from Calvin and Hobbes, the comic strip with the little boy and the tiger. And Calvin says, "You know, God put me on this earth to accomplish a certain number of things. And right now I'm so far behind, I'll never die." I think we get to that point where we feel like we have so many things going on that we'll never get it all done. But New Year's is about self-improvement. Right, if we went down to Beard's Fitness this week, I bet we'd see a whole lot of new faces. Or maybe not new faces, but faces that haven't been there the last 11 months or so. Right, we look at health clubs, we want to get in shape. Vitamin shops increase sales. They have a much more profitable time of year because people are trying to get healthier, do supplements. We make New Year's resolutions. But the thing is, about all those things, they're good, they're great in a lot of ways. But all of those things are, what about me? What should I do about me? We ask that question. And so this morning what I'd like to do is focus on a bigger, a broader, a more honest question. Right? Maybe even a question that's a little controversial or a little disturbing if we'll take it seriously. It's a question that, instead of focusing on what should I do about me, it's a question that helps us to think deeper and more meaningfully. And when I first heard this question, this is a kind of an adaptation from another message that I'd heard, I was stirred and I was encouraged and challenged. And so I hope you are this morning as well. But before we get to that question, I want to talk about Nehemiah. Nehemiah is from the Old Testament. If you pull out your sheet, on the chronological order of the New Testament, I think this is a great thing. I have this slid in my the front cover of my Bible. It breaks down when things happen in the Bible, because when you read the Bible, it's not necessarily in the order that it happened. And so if you look at it, way at the very end, on the far side over here is Nehemiah. He's at the very end of the history of the Old Testament. Last week we talked about, we were at in Deuteronomy, which was talking about the very beginning of the nation of Israel. And we see this nation of Israel being formed in Abraham, Isaac, Jacob being the father of the whole nation of Israel, and then moving into the promised land. And Nehemiah comes at the very, very end, after King David, after King Solomon, after all of their history. And we can see, even after Daniel in the lion's den, if you see there, it says the 70 years of exile below Daniel and Ezekiel there. There's a time in there where Israel, they were their own nation for a while. They had their kingdom. They had their system set up. They were in their country where God had promised them to be. But after listening to God, not following God's commands, they're pulled out of their nation. They're actually divided first. Israel's divided into the northern kingdom called Israel and the southern kingdom called Judah. And they divide. And Israel first is pulled away from their homeland, deported, moved out by the Babylonians that came and conquered. And then later, the Babylonians come back and they take Judah, take all the or a lot of the people, and they move them around as a way to try to keep the peace within their new conquered nation. And so 605 BC, that's the beginning of the Judah, the exile for Judah. And they're moved around and transferred around for various reasons. And when they come in 605, when the Babylonians come in to conquer the nation in 605, they destroy everything. Take out the walls, take out their place of worship, their temple. And they destroyed everything. About 70 years later, you can see there the 70 years of exile. Eventually, Cyrus, who's now the king of Persia, because Persia came in and conquered Babylon. That happens a ton, it seems like, in that area. Just nations come in and they just kind of take over what's been taken over. And it's kind of a mess in a lot of ways. But the Persians come in and take over Babylon. All that Babylon had conquered. And Cyrus is the king, and he starts sending people back into this nation, into Judah, into Jerusalem, into that area again. And first there's tens of thousands, and then hundreds of thousands of people return to that nation. And there's a rebuilding of the temple. If you read the book of Ezra, you can read about that. And there's others that are sent back that try to rebuild things, but it's hard. You know, if you imagine, and just because it's an easy example, if you think like Canada came in and conquered us, which would be funny, I think. But Canada came in and conquered us, took us all, and moved us all into Canada. And then 70 years later, we try to come back, and there's no structure. There's no organization. There's no overarching government. It's going to be hard to rebuild the life, to rebuild the walls, to rebuild the homes. And so that's 70 years later in about 538 BC that we see this happening. And then finally, we have Nehemiah's story in 444 BC. This is about 100 years after that, 140 years after the walls have been destroyed. And we see Nehemiah's story beginning here. And if I encourage you, we're going to be looking at Nehemiah for several weeks. And so if you get a chance this week, go ahead and read through the whole book of Nehemiah. It's just a few chapters. It wouldn't take you probably too long. But it's an amazing story of what Nehemiah does and what's happened in his world. So we're going to start in verse 1 of Nehemiah. And this it says, the words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah. In the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, when I was in the citadel of Susa, Hananiah, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile, and also about Jerusalem. And so we see Nehemiah is a prominent man in this country. The citadel of Susa was probably the king's summer home. So Nehemiah has a place of power, living amongst the king. And this group of men that had been part of probably one of the earlier trips that had been sent back to Jerusalem, Hananiah comes back. And Nehemiah asked him a question, what's going on? How are things happening and progressing in the nation in Jerusalem? We keep reading verse 3. They said to Nehemiah, they said to me, those who have survived the exile and are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates have been burned with fire. This isn't new news, right? We know 140 years or so before that the walls had been destroyed, that things were demolished at that time. So it's not new news that Nehemiah is getting here, but what he's probably hearing is really that the recent attempts to go back and rebuild have failed. There's great trouble and disgrace. And that great trouble and disgrace is a theme that Nehemiah uses throughout his book, throughout his story, that this idea that there's just turmoil and difficulties all around them. Let's keep reading in verse 4. It says, when I heard these things, I sat down and wept. And for some days I mourned and I fasted and I prayed before the God of heaven. Wept and mourned, fasted and prayed. It's this holistic approach. The inside of him is going to match the outside. He's fasting and he's weeping. Those those emotions are coming out in physical representations. It's a holistic approach to his sorrow, to the trouble that he's feeling because things aren't going well. It's an amazing example of the pride he has, the nationalistic pride that he has. He's probably never been to Jerusalem. He's probably never been back to that area. It's been 140 years since they've been brought out of there, and so he's probably several generations down the line. So it's an amazing example of how he feels in response to that situation. Verse 5, "Then I said, O Lord, God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and obey his commands. Let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant, that your servant is praying before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's house, have committed against you. We have acted very wickedly toward you. We have not obeyed the commandments, decrees, and laws that you gave your servant Moses." And so there's a few things that I just want to point out from Nehemiah's prayer. It's an amazing emotional prayer that he gives us. First, he praises and adores God, great and awesome God. Honors him, adores him, lifts his name up. He confesses. The next thing is he confesses the sins. Not only of himself, you know, we do that, right? We should do that, and we know we should do that, and we do that. But he also confesses the sins of his family. But on top of that, how many of us have ever confessed or apologized for the sin of us as a nation? You know, as a nation, he's apologizing and saying, these are the things that we've done. These are the sins that we have. And lastly, he says, we deserve to be thrown out. We deserved what we got. This is the thing that this is what you told us would happen if we didn't listen, and so we deserved it. And he's taking responsibility in some ways for the state that they're in. Verse 8, Nehemiah's prayer continues here. Remember the instructions you gave your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and obey my commands, then even if your exiled people are on the farthest horizon, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. Nehemiah is outlining the promises that God has made. He's almost telling God back, this is what you said you'd do. A while ago, a few months ago, it's probably been longer than that now, it seems. But I like to prepare my kids for what's going to happen next. It helps the transition, I've noticed a little bit, right? So 5 minutes, boys, we're going to bed. Okay, get ready, you know, make sure you're ready for lunch. We've got, you know, 10 minutes, we're going to have lunch. You know, just prepare them a little bit. And so I told them the one day that after quiet time, you guys can have a snack. They have quiet time for an hour or whatever, and then they could have a snack. And so Silas, our third, he came, went through quiet time, and I was on the computer messing around with something or whatever, and he comes up to me and says, all right, quiet time's over. It's time for a snack. And I said, okay, just a minute. He said, but you said after quiet time we would have a snack. And I was like, okay, we will have a snack right now. And so we get that way, I think. And you know, that's what Nehemiah is doing here. He's going to God, and he's probably being less rude about it than Silas was. But at the same time, parents need to understand and follow up with what they're saying too, I suppose. But he's telling God, this is what you said you'd do. This is what you said to do, reminding him as if God needed to be reminded. And we'll finish out this section here in verse 10. They are your servants, the people of Israel, are your servants and your people, who you redeemed by your great strength and your mighty hand. O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man. I was cupbearer to the king. And so he wraps up his prayer, Nehemiah wraps up his prayer with a final reminder that God had delivered the people, that God had worked in their history, that he had done these things and accomplished so much for the people. And then the final statement of I was cupbearer to the king kind of seems out of place, kind of like this tag that Nehemiah throws on the end of that chapter. But really, he's pointing and saying that he had a place of prominence. The cupbearer, a lot of times we think of as someone that's a wine taster, right? Someone that drinks the wine before they give it to the king in case it's poisoned or something. But he also probably had some kind of financial office in the kingdom. He had prominence. He had authority. And even Nehemiah, though, didn't have the authority just to go and talk to the king whenever he wanted. You didn't do that. You didn't just go and seek an audience with the king by your own will and own power. You could be executed for that. But he's praying to God to provide him success. When he says success in the presence of this man, he's talking about going and talking to the king. And as we read through the rest in Nehemiah 2 and beyond, we'll see what he's trying to do and accomplish in that. But he's putting his plan in action. And so three quick points to express from Nehemiah, really Nehemiah 1, but also the whole book, is first that there's this goal of rebuilding the walls. The goal of rebuilding the walls was partially structural, partially for protection, because obviously if there's no walls, people can just kind of walk through us. But it also had this idea of bringing order out of chaos, had this idea of bringing civility out of the uncivilized, and ultimately to bring life out of death. To bring life out of death, the resurrection or the raising of the walls is bringing life to the people. Second thing is that in Nehemiah's initial fourfold response, weeping, fasting, and praying, and mourning, hearing about the news of his beloved city. And lastly, we saw that Nehemiah looked at the historical work of God, what God had promised, what God had done in the past, and looking to that and reminding even God of what he'd done. And so when we look especially at that fourfold response of Nehemiah, and we see that it said, you know, he's weeping and he's mourning, he's fasting and he's praying, we could probably sum that up by saying, ultimately, it broke Nehemiah's heart. It broke his heart. And so the bigger question this time of year, bigger question for us at any time of the year, is not what can I do about me, but what breaks your heart? What breaks your heart when you look at the community, when you look at the country, when you look at our economy, the schools, families, children, when you're watching TV and you say, I can't watch this, I'm going to change the channel, because it breaks your heart, because it makes us uncomfortable. What's that thing when you talk about it, your friends and your family, they say, oh, there she goes again, rambling on about that. There he goes again. Oh, we'll just leave him alone. He's going to be on that for a while now. Right? What are those things in our life that hang us up, that capture our emotions, that make us angry in a way that's not malicious or selfish, but maybe righteous? It's an injustice that we see in our world, and we feel like we need to do something about it. The psychology, and I'd like to kind of combine the two, because I think each on its own misses something, but the psychology of men versus women is that men try to do, right? Men want to just do something, right? We hear about a problem. We want to accomplish something, finish it, fix it, make it right. Whereas women, they want to feel it and work through their emotions about it. And to the extreme of both those, and that's a generalization, I realize, but to the extreme of both of those, they both miss something. If we're just doing something, we're not relating to it. If we're just feeling it, we're maybe not accomplishing anything in the long run. And so knowing that about the emotions, I hope to bring both together to balance them out a little bit this morning. And so there are four things that I want to address before we look at ourselves and really how we fit this out and fill this out. Is first, we need to focus on what needs to be done around me. What needs to be done around me versus this time of year we talk about what about me? What needs to be done about me? We need to look at the needs of those around us, those in our community, in our neighborhoods, even just within our families. What are the needs around me? The Latin proverb says, what man is a man who doesn't make the world better? Or what woman is a woman who doesn't make the world better? We see this idea that there's things around us that need to be different, need to be changed. And the thing is, a lot of times, I do this myself a lot, If we don't ask that question, if we don't say that, what can I do about that, we start to blame others. Right? Well, it's the president's fault. It's Congress's fault. It's the government of the state of Illinois' fault. I think I've heard that a few times lately, actually. Which, I don't know, maybe they deserve it. But if we're just blaming people, we're not accomplishing things. Maybe we say, well, it's the parents' fault. That's why the kids are that way. Or it's the mayor's fault. Or maybe it's the pastor's fault. Sorry. We blame others, looking for responsibility in other people instead of taking responsibility for ourselves. Blame ultimately is not a strategy for changing things. It's ultimately how we avoid changing things. What would happen if we took all of that time and that effort to blame others and we started to put that into useful, practical work, having a meaningful impact, really answering the question, what breaks our heart, instead of saying, well, they need to do their job and fix it. What's something I can do right now in my circumstances to help? Because Jesus taught us that devotion to God, devotion to Him, is measured in devotion to others. Devotion to God is measured in terms of our devotion to others. And we see this throughout Jesus' ministry. He does this all the time, teaches it all the time, that the way He's showing His love for God is how He's loving those around Him. People who are actively following Jesus make the lives of other people around them better. A lot of times it should happen organically. When we have those fruits of the Spirit, love and joy and peace and patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, and self-control, the people around us should benefit from that. Right? If we're more patient with people, more loving with people, the people around us should naturally benefit from that. And so Jesus taught us that we need to look at others, we need to love others as a way to show our devotion and our love for God. But Jesus also taught that people have inherent value. Inherent value, not ascribed value. And I love this part of Jesus' ministry. There's lots of things about Jesus' ministry that we can like, right, and love. But we miss this a lot of times. We kind of gloss over this part because Jesus was revolutionary in the way he ascribed value to people. And we assume it in our culture because of the way Jesus taught and changed the world. Because looking at his work in John 4, the Samaritan woman, women, much less Samaritan women weren't supposed to talk to men in public. Weren't supposed to talk to any men in public, but basically just at home with their husbands. And so when Jesus interacts with her at the well, and if you haven't read John 4, it's a great story. I love that story. Jesus gives her value by talking to her, by encouraging her, by challenging her. He gives her value. And then there's the story of in all four or all three of the first three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus says, "Let the little children come to me." At that time, children had less value than women, and women had very little, if any, value to the people at that time. And Jesus says, "Let the children come to me. I want to love the children. They have value just inherently." And then lastly, Jesus interacted with sinners. We know the story of Zacchaeus, the wee little man, climbs the tree to see Jesus, and Jesus says, "You know, I'm going to your house today." Jesus ate with sinners. He met with sinners. He loved sinners. He gave them value by being with them. All of us in this room have that value. Your neighbors have that value. Every one of us, every single one of us have that value. And the people around us have that value. And Jesus teaches us that. And it's not value that's given because they're going to do something for us or because they can accomplish something in our society, but just because of who made them and because God cares for them, loves them. And we all have the potential to change somebody's world. Some of us have the potential to change the world of many around us. We all have the opportunity to change the lives of somebody around us. Some of us have the potential to change the world of many around us. And so This morning, I want to leave you with four final thoughts, four things for us to work with this morning. And then we're going to watch a short little video to kind of cement it all together, hopefully. But four areas of our life that if we are able to ask the question and work through them in this way, I feel like we can make a major impact. God can work through us in so many amazing ways. And so looking at the story and the example of Nehemiah and asking the question, what breaks my heart? We see that Nehemiah first had a sensitive heart. He was emotional. He allowed his emotions to become real. Don't turn the channel when we get emotional about something. Don't walk away from the computer or close the browser when we read something that hurts us. Work through those emotions. This is something personally that I've only worked at the last few months. Still really new to it. Because guys, we're not supposed to have emotions. And we're told we're not supposed to have emotions, right? When we grow up, maybe we never taught that. I know I was in a home and a church and even in our culture that I wasn't told to suppress them or to push them away, but I just learned that somehow. And I think we just picked that up, especially as men, that we're not supposed to have emotions, except for anger. For some reason, anger seems to be fairly acceptable to a certain extent. Right, we have this limit on our emotions. And so we need to work through them. We have to follow Nehemiah's example and be willing to weep and to mourn, to pray and to fast. And so we have sensitive hearts to what God wants to do, but we also have questioning minds, processing through the things that God wants us to do. Challenging the thoughts of our own thoughts, the thoughts of those around us. Being willing to look beyond just the things right in front of us, but to look beyond to the peripheral, the things that really need our work in their lives. It's about proceeding, making progress, but doing it carefully. When we look at a surgeon, right, we don't want to go to a surgeon that posts on their walls 100 people cut this day today or whatever they want to put. I don't know. Right? It's not about numbers with a surgeon. Hopefully, anyway. It's about doing it diligently, going slow, processing, and doing it well. And that's what this is about. It's about questioning and processing. Nehemiah spent months, probably over 4 months, working through these things before he took action. And so we have a questioning mind, a sensitive heart, but we also have prayerful brokenness. Finding ways to be broken before God, taking our emotions and our thoughts and laying them down before God to see what he desires us to do. You know, like I said, Nehemiah spent that time, those months, preparing for this, and God was preparing Nehemiah during those times too. A lot of times we just want to get past the pain. We want to get past the brokenness. We want to feel better. And so we don't allow ourselves to dwell in those areas, to work through those things, to allow God to prepare us for whatever he has planned for us. And so we need to be in prayer and be broken in that way. But lastly, we just need to leave the details up to God. Leave the details up to God. Nehemiah, there's no way Nehemiah could have known all of the things that he would face as he went back, dealing with the problems that he would deal with. But he made a plan. He stepped forward and he allowed God to work out the details. Right? We teach our kids this idea of how big are you? Right? How big are you? We ask our kids really early on. And we want them to say, I'm so big. They stand up a little taller, raise their hands and say, I'm so big. And we want to teach them that they're not small or weak and that they can face the challenges of life. But sometimes we don't allow God to be that big in our lives. We need to ask, how big is our God? How big is your God? Is he big enough to fill in those details? Is he big enough for the day-to-day, for the challenges that we face? Are we able to give him some of those things? So we leave the details up to God. And ultimately, we have no idea what hangs in the balance for our decisions. When we embrace the burden that God has placed on our heart, and I guarantee almost all of us have something that nags at us. Maybe it's been suppressed or pushed away for years, but we have no idea what hangs in the balance of that decision. And ultimately, this time of year, if we look at ourselves, if we want to become better people, if we want to become a better person, we need to do something to make the world a better place. Do something to make the world a better place.